Oh, such a clutch off-season pickup, Dave.
I know, right? I was worried we'd bring back the same team.
Oh, no, I meant those blackout motorized shades. MVP of the room.
Blinds.com made it crazy affordable to replace our old blinds.
Hard to install?
No, it's easy. Even you could do it.
Nice.
I installed these and then got some for my mom, too.
What, you fly across the country to do the install?
Nope. Blinds.com can do it all. All she had to do was pick what she wanted. She talked to a design consultant for free and scheduled a professional measure and install.
Look at you, Hall of Fame son.
Oh, I just picked the winning team. They're the number one online retailer of custom window coverings in the world.
Oh, Blinds.com is the GOAT.
The GOAT.
Shop Blinds.com right now and get up to 40% off select styles, plus a free professional measure and a 100% satisfaction guarantee. Save up to 40% at Blinds.com. Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Ah, can't you see it? A glistening 100-megawatt solar field begging to be built? It's photovoltaic modules and balance of system powering a renewable energy tomorrow that's squeaky clean? We know that unless you have the right supplier, that world might just be a fantasy. But here at Graybar, with years of renewables experience, we live in that world. Get in touch to see for yourself.
We are now ready to depart.
Book your visit at graybar.com. Yep, Graybar does that.
Do you believe you were wrongfully terminated for speaking up against your employer? Wilshire Law Firm isn't afraid to go up against corporate giants and will protect you every step of the way. Get justice and feel safe. Call the experts at Wilshire Law Firm at 1-800-800-3333.
Welcome back, folks. Joining us, Guy Williams, President, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust, as he joins us every Monday at this time, and we appreciate same. And Happy New Year to you, Guy Williams.
Oh, thank you very much. Happy New Year to you. Good to be with you.
So, Guy, breaking news. After meeting with President Joe Biden, Mayor LaToya Cantrell just announced that Mardi Gras has been granted the Level 1 Special Assessment Rating, SEER, the highest potential threat rating that government can assign to an event. And Level 1 includes significant events with national and or international importance that require extensive federal interagency support. Obviously, the Super Bowl has that classification, and now Mardi Gras has that classification as well. Didn't know if you wanted to opine on that, Guy, but that is the most breaking news.
Well, I think it's very important for us to have security in New Orleans because we are a tourist city. A lot of our economy is driven by tourist dollars. Our standard of living is better because of tourists. We have more restaurants than any city our size would normally have because of tourists. And if tourists don't feel safe coming here, that's a problem. I would press the mayor hard, and whoever the new mayor is, we really need to rebuild the police force. The new chief is doing a good job, but she's doing it without a full staff, and they've just got to sweep away the obstacles and make it to the point where we really have a fully staffed police force.
Yeah, obviously that solves a lot of issues and problems. And, you know, one of the things that I've been concerned about through obviously this, you know, we're just 5 days post-event, tragedy here of this terrorist attack on Bourbon Street is the reputation of our city as being a kind of built to host, as New Orleans and Company has coined it. We've got a lot of messaging going out there and continue to remind people to put this tragic event in context. I read a list of over the last 5 years how many ISIS-supported events, tragic events that occurred around the world have actually happened. And I hope it creates pause for folks to really gain a better understanding of why this is, why the threat is what it is, and the difficulty of dealing with that threat.
Well, and I think it is important. Certainly, we absolutely don't want to minimize it, but these sort of attacks have occurred in Paris, Rome, Berlin, New York. And so it's an unfortunate fact of life. We need to learn all we can and minimize the risk, but it's certainly not something where New Orleans is uniquely dangerous. And I think we are working very hard to make New Orleans even safer. And we've done a real good job of hosting big events. I can't think of another city that hosts as many big outdoor events as we do, because you mentioned Mardi Gras, which we do every year, but we also do Jazz Fest and French Quarter Fest, which sure. are real big outdoor events, and we do it very successfully.
No doubt, for sure. Let's pivot real quick, because this just happened this morning, and I mean, the way that we conduct ourselves in government just completely mystifies me. President Joe Biden bans new offshore oil and drilling in more than 625 million acres of federal waters, knowing that that was the cornerstone of the platform of President-elect Donald Trump. Just seems as though we're engaged in these retaliatory acts back and forth and forgetting about how important this is to our economy. Your thoughts?
Yeah, it really is unfortunate for a number of reasons, but I'll start with the environmental reason. When scientists look at oil and gas extraction, the cleanest extraction in the world is Saudi Arabia, and that's for a simple reason. You just dip a straw in the desert, and there you get oil. But the second cleanest is offshore oil and gas right here in Louisiana, because we've changed our methods. We pay real attention to safety. We pay real attention to emissions. And so when you limit Louisiana oil and gas production, it doesn't mean the world's going to quit using oil and gas. It means that it will use oil and gas from places that are less clean and less environmentally sensitive. So this is a step backwards for the environment. We know that green energy will, as it becomes efficient, gradually replace oil and gas. It can't do it today. It can't do it within a decade. So in the meantime, things like this actually make the environment worse. And it really is sort of a political tit for tat. And it's interesting, we had a lot of talk about, being diplomatic and working across the aisle. But this is sort of an egregious shot out the door as you leave office.
I'm almost getting to the mindset, Guy, that in this lame duck period that we restrict the president from issuing executive orders and this and that, unless it has something to do with national security, because this has become just complete gamesmanship, and we're really kind of losing sight of what's in the best interest of the country as a whole.
Yeah, and I think these sort of things actually come back to haunt you, because the genius of the American system is that we have elections every 2 and 4 years. So it won't be long before the House seats are up for election. And if you do things that voters really don't like, and voters just in November said they wanted to see happen, and you're standing in the way, I think it'll backfire for the party in power. So I would not recommend getting ahead of public opinion on things like this.
Yeah. Let's pivot again. The U.S. Treasury, they've been in the news for a whole host of things, but a recent breach there reveals a lot that is kind of troubling, right?
Yeah, this is very, very troubling. We in America talked about the Cold War, where U.S. was having this Cold War with Russia. We're right now having an electronic war with China, and no one's named it yet. Maybe you can come up with a good name for it, but maybe a cyber war or internet war, but it's going on, and China's state hacking agency is making a deliberate effort to hack into American companies. Now, phase one was stealing intellectual property. And we saw that in the auto industry. We saw that in the machine tool industry. And unfortunately, a lot of people fell for the idea that it's great to manufacture in China, great to have Chinese partners. What they didn't realize is the Chinese plan was, once you're in China, we're going to steal your intellectual property. Then we're going to leapfrog you and start making your products, and your market will decline. And so automakers that were in China are now seeing they have less market share. The companies they compete with stole their intellectual property. Well, it moved from there to defense. The Chinese have a very similar jet plane to the F-35. You really can't tell the difference when you look at them side by side. And we know from Defense Department officials that a lot of the plans were stolen. But now we're moving into a third phase where they're targeting agencies and utilities. The Chinese have hacked into ports, grids, telecom, but also into DOJ, Department of State, Department of Commerce, and Department of Treasury. And this really is very concerning. The DOJ one was particularly concerning because one of the things they got is the list of everyone that was being wiretapped in the U.S. So if you think about counterintelligence, maybe, you know, the FBI identified 50, 100, who knows, how many potential foreign spies there were, and started wiretapping. Well, the Chinese now know who we were wiretapping. So they can give a heads up to their friends in Russia. They can remove their own agents. And it really deals a body blow to us in counterintelligence. The Treasury is a big mess because, you know, that's the fundamental wiring for the U.S. economy. And the Chinese gained access, gained passwords, and, you know, we're hearing from the Treasury, well, no confidential documents were accessed, but I don't know that we could know that for sure. But we do know that China has been hacking into first corporate offices, then utilities, and now government agencies with an awful lot of success.
So where, I mean, and I heard recently the Chinese were dragging an anchor right off the coast of Taiwan to yank up internet cables that are there. We've seen that as well in the North Sea, and we're seeing it in a number of other different places. This concerted, I mean, where does this end? What's the end game here?
Well, I think the challenge that we face is a lack of understanding of the Chinese method. And I have friends in the State Department say, you know, if you imagine you're standing 10 feet away from a Chinese diplomat and say, look, just stay away, please. Next thing you know, they're 5 feet away, then three, then two, then 1 foot. It's like, is this too close? Then 6 inches, then 1 inch. And it's always a push to see when you push back. And so their method is push on all fronts, whether it's dragging the anchor, whether it's supplying, you know, violating sanctions and buying oil from Russia, supplying technology to Russia for their war in Ukraine, violating the law of the sea in the Philippines. And the point is to just push and see how far they can get before somebody pushes back. And we've been reluctant to push back because we feel like that's escalation. But if you don't, you really are going to be in big trouble. And as you say, they've gone from electronic spying to literally cutting cables with their ship anchors. And I think the people in that region are beginning to take that seriously. They seized one ship, and I think we need to say, look, you're going to have to pay for these damages. And until you do, your ships can't pass through this area.
Why? At some point in time, I guess the countries of, you know, Europe and the United States and others have to stand up to this threat, right? I mean, there really hadn't been much of a response to a lot of this.
No, and if you're an adversary and you're getting away with it, it's the same thing a bully does. You know, how much can I get away with? And as they get away with things, they realize, okay, I can do a little more. And they pocket each gain and say, okay, what else can I do? The ships really, I mean, that's very egregious. It's very obvious. You look on the seabed, you see this anchor being dragged for, you know, 10 miles, and then the anchor's missing from the ship. Gee, we don't know where it went. I mean, it's like Homer Simpson. You know, nobody saw me. You can't prove it. Really? You know, I didn't do it. Of course you did. You're guilty, and there have to be consequences. And I think that's the missing part. I think we need to get together with our European allies and say, look, if you cut a cable, you have to pay all the costs to fix it. And if you cut another cable, then we're going to ban your ships from transiting this area.
Guy, and we haven't seen like a calculation of the cost of this disruption either, have we?
No, and I think the companies are a little reluctant to discuss that because you don't want to let your adversary know how much they hurt you. So I have no idea what it costs to replace or repair one of these cables. I know it's obviously doable, but it's a mess. You're dealing with deep, cold water, and that's going to be a challenge. And I think the one thing we can't do is let China think that all of this is risk-free, that they can hack into our ports, our telecom, our grid, and that there's no consequence. So I think we need to start thinking and calibrating. I think it's less risky to draw the line now than to wait until China has done something really egregious like invade Taiwan.
Yeah, but, you know, because there is a peripheral cost, too, right, of the cost of doing all businesses in the private sector, public sector, and everything else that relies on that. I mean, fortunately, we've had a level of redundancy that we've been able to stand up relatively quick to cover. But what happens on, you know, that day that's not available?
Well, and I think that's, if you look back strategically, I think that's what China's planning on is, If they invade Taiwan and if we respond forcefully, then they will use the hacking that they've done to shut down, you know, ports, grids, telecom, internet, and all the other things that they've hacked into that we know about and don't know about, and really cause, you know, major disruption to life in America. So part of it is they want us to know that they can hit back without shooting a shot at us, but you know, we really, because we haven't done anything, they feel like this is risk-free. And so from their perspective, if they do something in Taiwan, something somewhere else, and we respond militarily, they have the ability to really cause some economic havoc in the U.S. And so that would make any president a bit nervous in terms of how they respond.
How volatile do you think this particular situation, you know, if you're willing to breach our U.S. Treasury, is there a signal other than that that's a bigger threat? I mean, short of, you know, military action.
Yeah, and I don't know who else they could breach. I don't know if they breached the White House communications, but Department of State, Department of Commerce, Treasury Department, Department of Justice. So, you know, they're saying we can go after any of your agencies with pretty much impunity. And I think it's time for us to say, and to the other G20 countries, say, folks, when China joined these alliances, they agreed to certain rules of the road. We actually have to enforce them. And I think that providing some clarity that, look, you have to actually do what you agreed to do. And if you do, you can stay in the G20. If not, we're going to kick you out. Then you have some consequences. And I think President Xi is just waiting to see how far he can step before there are any consequences, because so far it's been risk-free for him.
Yeah, this is going to be interesting as it plays itself out. I would think that this would be something that the Trump administration is going to have to take on early on in their administration, working with our partners and our allies in Europe.
Yeah, it's a big challenge. And I don't think it's too much to say to China, look, we simply want you to follow the rules that you agreed to voluntarily. Yeah, that's where we're going to start. Is you follow the rules that you agreed to, like the law of the sea, like the UN provisions on human rights, and the provisions on free trade. We'll go back to following the rules.
Yeah. All right, we got to get to a break. We're visiting with Guy Williams, President, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. When we come back, we'll talk about Trudeau's resignation and what that means. When we return, stay with us.
Hey guys, it's Jim Costa from Cash the Ticket. If you're planning on betting the NFL playoffs, buckle up. betting football's hard enough as it is. We're doing the research for you. So listen to Cash the Ticket with Mike Valeni and I. We'll be dropping new episodes for every single playoff game. And that's going to be storylines leading into it, so some good football stuff, but also the betting nuggets you're looking for. Sides, totals, trends, player props, throw those in there too. Pre-game and post-game, we're going to be all over the postseason. Subscribe to Cash the Ticket on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, folks. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said this morning that he will resign after almost a decade in power, bowing to the members of his party who have been calling on him to step aside ahead of an election later this year. Trudeau is the latest standard bearer for progressive politics to suffer a voter backlash amid economic retreat, discontent with aggressive climate policies, and a growing resistance to immigration. Guy, this was an announcement this morning, I think, took a lot of folks by surprise.
It did. It follows the same sort of thing that's been happening in Europe with the French government falling and the German government. And what we see is the prime minister, who started out very popular in 2008, gradually lost support in parliament. He had formed a minority government and was ruling from a minority position. But even members of his own party said, look, we've lost confidence. We're going to lose the next election as things stand, which is October 10th of this year. And so, you know, we have odd things in America, but in Canada, they have a concept which is called prorogue. And what that means is you discontinue a session of parliament without dissolving it. So his government is stepping down as prime minister. They're going to have to select a new prime minister and then build a new coalition government. And it's interesting because when you look at the opposition platform, what they're saying is we're looking for something that will reduce taxes, cut the carbon tax, reduce government meddling and red tape, and reduce inflation. Very similar to our election, very similar to the European election, where voters just got fed up with it, and particularly fed up with the increases in taxes, increases in inflation and cost, particularly energy cost. And so he's out, and the speculation is you'll have a much more conservative government that will step in. And, of course, it really leaves a tremendous vacuum because President Trump has said he wants to change the terms of the NAFTA agreement. So I don't know who's going to negotiate that. A new government's going to have to be created, but we're in an interim situation without somebody with clear authority to negotiate on the Canadian side.
Yeah, I don't believe in coincidences. You know, Justin Trudeau and Donald Trump did not have a warm and fuzzy relationship by any stretch of the imagination.
No, Trudeau had been pretty vocal in his criticism and pretty vocal in his statements about what he thought about our incoming president. So, yeah, I think he realized he was not going to be the person to negotiate, and that's probably good for Canada. And it actually may end up with them getting a better outcome than they might have otherwise.
Yeah, that's going to be interesting. But, you know, the comment you just made that this is following in a lot of what we're seeing in Europe as well, a lot of this goes right to these aggressive climate policies that, you know, that have been a drag on the economy in Germany and other both Western and Eastern European countries, and obviously Canada as well.
Well, and he was very explicit at the World Economic Forum in Davos. He said he wanted to phase out the oil and gas industry in Canada. Now, Canada is the fourth largest oil and gas producer, tremendous jobs creator. They do a good job, just like the U.S. does, in producing oil that's relatively clean compared to people like Russia that have no environmental standards. And the Canadians just got tired of it. The other thing that frustrated Canadians is the increased taxes for climate purposes. And one of the frustrations was Canadians realized that they were paying higher taxes, but it wasn't actually going to make any difference. You know, it's one thing to pay taxes and, you know, heaven help us if we had another major conflict, you know, like World War II, we'd pay much higher taxes and in order to support the military and win. But if you're facing a major problem like climate change and you're paying taxes, but your strategy won't make any difference, that's very frustrating to the average citizen. And that's where they were, because the challenge for a climate activist is Canada's not the problem. India, China, and Indonesia are the problems, and to a lesser extent, Russia. And they're all increasing emissions. So if you eliminate Canadian emissions, literally close the oil and gas industry, it wouldn't slow climate change in any measurable degree. In fact, they couldn't even measure the change that that would make if Canada went to zero, which is impossible in the short run. So that frustration between a government policy that made no sense but cost a lot is one of the things that cost him his job.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see where this ends up, and obviously the relationship that we have or don't have with Canada in some respects. Let's pivot, Guy, to the New Orleans downtown office buildings, the crisis there. What are we seeing?
Oh, my goodness. I wish the news were better. You know, people always talk about, well, what's happening with offices? And the news is really not good. People also tend to get a little off track and say, well, the banks are going to have a lot of problems because of offices. This isn't a bank problem. It's a city problem. And the mortgages are not held by banks. They're held by investment funds and by bond funds. But in New Orleans, we've had a string of bad news. And it started with the DXC, which is the old Freeport MacMoran building. It was foreclosed on, $30 million of debt, sold for $18.5 million. And you and I talked about this last year. I just think this was the biggest missed opportunity that the city has had in quite a while. For $18.5 million, the city could have bought the building, for another $10 million renovated it to hold City Hall, and then have space left over to rent. And we would have really a first-class place for City Hall, high visibility, you know, great parking, you know, nice looking building. And, you know, we let that opportunity go away. Well, those opportunities are continuing to go away. And the Energy Building, which is an attractive building, pretty good occupancy, was foreclosed upon. And we now have new ownership. The management is still local. Corporate Realty, which is owned by Gail Benson, manages it. But Triangle Capital is now the new owner, and they stepped in because Energy could not refinance their bond debt. So the Energy Building was foreclosed. The big shoe that people are waiting to drop is the old One Shell Square, now the Hancock Whitney Building. Next year, when Shell moves out, occupancy will drop to 55%. You can't service the mortgage with 55% occupancy. There's $108 million of bond debt outstanding. So if you do the math, it just doesn't work. And one of the problems is when big buildings get foreclosed, like Energy, like DXC, the new owner has a new lower basis, and so they can afford to reduce rent in order to fill their building. Well, that's good for the new owner, but the old owners that have old debt are now facing competitors that have a much lower basis and can afford to rent for less. So it really presents a challenge for the management team at the Hancock Whitney building, because we know Shell's moving out. They've got a commitment to a new building, and they're going to vacate 330,000 square feet. So that's going to be a very tough challenge and really unfortunate for the city, because we need people to be in these buildings because they support everything else. They support, you know, transit, they support the restaurants, they support all the different shops. And when you have low vacancy and foreclosures, it really becomes a challenge for the CBD.
Yeah, it's good. I mean, and it almost couldn't happen at a worse time for us, right?
You're exactly right. Now, I was going to say, you're right, because a lot of things are flowing the wrong direction. If you own an office building, you have to charge for utilities and insurance. And most of these office leases are triple net. But with insurance costs going up, maintenance costs going up, tenants are looking at those rates and saying, gee, I don't know if I can afford that, and I don't know if I want to stay. And so if you're in a high-priced building, you start looking for options. One of these foreclosed buildings could be an option. And then we also have some challenges. The old Whitney building on St. Charles Avenue was sold in 2019 with the idea it'd be quickly redeveloped. It's been 5 years, and there's no redevelopment plan in place. So you've got a big sort of eyesore sitting there. The old Charity Hospital is on the ropes, and there's a fight now between the city and the developers, including Tulane, on, you know, how can you make it work? And the unfortunate reality is, with today's rents, you can't afford to build new construction or to do a total renovation. The numbers just don't work. The average rental rate doesn't cover the cost of new construction or new renovation. So you need a significant subsidy, either in the form of tax credits or government investment. And as you say, it's a tough time because we're looking at a challenging budget. And these are things that are important to the city, but need to be redone. So this is going to be something that's going to face the new mayor very, very quickly, when whoever that person is.
And, you know, and then with a lot of what's going on in federal government, you know, the GAO leases a number of office buildings and space downtown. And if we're not going to have people back in the office and work towards that means, this administration, I think, is going to look to eliminate a lot of these leases. You know, because the Biden administration has put up a whole lot of barriers to compelling people to go back to the office, and to overcome that is going to be costly. And if they're not successful, they'll say, all right, well, we'll just negate these leases. We'll get out.
Yeah. One of the interesting things that really flew under the radar was an agreement by the administration with the federal workers unions to basically enshrine the right to remote work. So that's going to make it very challenging for the government efficiency group to insist that everybody come back to work. So we'll have legal challenges, but this is another one of those out-the-door moves of, you know, we're going to put in some policies that we like, but when you don't go to work, you don't need as much office space. So it has to be one way or the other. If you're going to work, then maybe you need the office space. If you don't, then the federal government will be canceling office space. And that's one more challenge, because we do have significant federal office space leases in New Orleans. I mean, nothing like Washington, D.C., but that's one more thing that's going to put pressure on this market. And I think the biggest challenge we have is we just don't have demand to fill the space. You know, there are cities like Austin and Nashville that are building new office buildings because they have demand by companies wanting to move in. And our objective as a city needs to be to look at, okay, what do we need to do to create demand so that we have more people moving in? Because that's ultimately the solution. Right now we're working toward dealing with a very bad problem in the short run. But in the long run, we've got to solve it with additional demand.
No doubt. Got to get to a break. We're visiting with Guy Williams, president of Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. We'll be right back. Stay with us. The Congress just convened in a joint session today to certify President-elect Donald Trump and Vice President-elect J.D. Vance's electoral victory this past November. This was presided over by Vice President Kamala Harris. They needed 270 electoral votes were needed to win, and the Republican ticket captured 312 votes. So this election has now been certified. We're back with Guy Williams, President, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. Guy, let's pivot to an issue that a lot of folks I don't think are really familiar with, called dynamic pricing. What does that mean?
Yeah, dynamic pricing means you can pay different prices for the same thing. In the most extreme cases, Amazon uses algorithms to price their products. And they say on their customer service website, our pricing is based on availability, demand, sales, events, and other factors. One of the other factors is they're constantly testing to see who will pay what. So if you happen to live in a neighborhood where people are paying a little more for something, you may pay a higher price than someone across town. And this is something that the old catalog retailers used to do when they'd mail out catalogs and you'd call in an order. They'd say, well, what's your zip code? And they had different prices based on different zip codes. Well, Amazon is using it and others to just see how much they can charge. Now, we're all used to surge pricing in things like Uber and Lyft. If there's a lot of demand, the prices go up. Concert tickets, same thing. You know, once they're on the resale market, then you find out what the real price is. But this dynamic pricing is being marketed to retailers and also to restaurants. And the idea is when you're looking at, instead of a paper menu, you click on that code on your cell phone, you can change the pricing. You can change it every 5 minutes. You can change it when demand is high. You can change it when you're trying to move a product. Wendy's was experimenting with this. They got a lot of backlash, and they said, oh, no, we're just going to use it to give discounts at slow times. But the idea is you can manage pricing based upon, as Amazon says, demand and other factors, namely whatever people would be willing to pay.
I was talking to someone the other day. They were snow skiing in Utah, and the daily price of a Lyft ticket changed based on demand. So today it might have been $195 for a Lyft ticket. Tomorrow it could have been $220. It was crazy.
Yeah, and, you know, that's tough for the skier because typically if you're on vacation, you're there to ski and you don't really have much option.
Right.
I think there's a different type of dynamic pricing that I sort of wish we would apply here, which is a little more rational. It's for utilities, where in times of high demand, they say, look, if you just won't use your washer dryer right now, you'll save money. But if you insist on using it, it is, you know, 102 degrees outside. Everybody just came home from work. It's going to be expensive. And I remember one of my relatives in Virginia said, oh, no, don't turn on the dishwasher now. So why not? It's not full. Said, oh, no, the pricing is going to go down in 10 minutes. So, well, I could live with that. Those are changes you could accommodate.
You'd be washing clothes and drying clothes at midnight.
Right. Well, and you know, with timers and such, you could, or you do it when you're at work, and
sure,
that's where the smart appliances actually begin to make sense. It helps the utilities match demand. But you know, we have the same thing on cruise lines, and we have a lot of cruises out of New Orleans. It's worthwhile to keep an eye on those prices because if you live here in New Orleans, as it gets close to the cruise date, those prices can drop, and if you have some flexibility, you can take advantage of the dynamic pricing because they for sure don't want to sail with any open cabins because the ship's going to cost the same regardless.
Right. Absolutely, for sure. As always, we truly enjoy the conversation with you, Guy Williams. Thank you so much for joining us, and have a great week.
Oh, you're very welcome. Good to be with you.
Thank you, sir. We'll be right back and check in with Scoot to see what he has coming your way. Stay with us. Got a text here that says a number of the high-tech stadiums I work in have plans, or at least will have, the flexibility to change beer and other prices based on the length of the line. mean, that is absolutely crazy as it relates to this dynamic price and changing so fast on so many different products. And I've heard more and more a lot of stories. I was just talking about the ski lift tickets. I remember when I first started skiing, $8 is what I paid. Now it's over $200 in some locations to ski. I don't know how people afford to do it any longer. Scoot's up next, and I think he joins us. Scoot, what do we have coming up?
Yeah, Mount Hood, just outside of Portland, $160 for a lift ticket this year.
Oh, wow.
$160. I mean, I remember when it was $40. It's just really, it's amazing. And like, you know, by the way, the skis, the snowboards, that stuff's kind of pricey too. Yeah. All right, we're going to talk about a report that came out in 2019 that really sheds a very, very negative light on Mayor Cantrell and the city of New Orleans when it comes to safety of the French Quarter. Plus, we'll, you know, update some of the things that happened on the Golden Globe Awards last night, and a few other things. Still very early in this new year. It's back to reality for a lot of people, so we'll have a lot to talk about this afternoon.
All righty, folks. Well, stay tuned. Scoot's up next. Hope you enjoyed today's show. Have a great Monday evening. We'll see you in the morning.